Thank you for coming back to the second part of my conversation with Jeff Mack, the Executive Vice President of the Matthew Shepard Foundation. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to this podcast. You don't want to miss out on any episodes of Finding Diversity. Now let's get back to it. We often hear that diversity, equity, and inclusion matters to businesses, but their data tells a different story. So what is the missing piece? On Finding Diversity, we tell real stories of what has worked for others and provide experiences that will inspire you. I'm Justice Thompson, and this is where our journey begins.
What I will say is last year when I was at the gala, I think there is a temptation for listeners to sometimes write this off as a tragedy and an interesting story and a sad one, but a story. And I want to say, having seen Judy and Dennis get up on stage, I think what is most powerful about specifically the Matthew Shepard Foundation is that it just seemed like two parents who just really loved their son and would prefer for none of this to exist, to just have their son.
Right.
And you can see it on their face that it's just a dad that wants to play catch with his son, maybe take him out for dinner one last time, a mom that just wants to get that phone call on Sunday nights. And so I would encourage listeners to take this with the spirit it was given, that this is horrific in the worst sense, and if anything, it should inspire you to act. This is not just a press play podcast that you get to listen to. My hope, and the reason why we call this Finding the Missing Piece, is in the hopes that the title is actionable, it inspires action, that we are constantly trying to improve and become better. And so I think, you know, I thank you for sharing that story, because it is so powerful.
One of the things that is in the Laramie Project, Judy's not in it much, and Dennis's speech in it is very impassioned, because he's like, when he says, you know, we're not going to give you the death penalty, I want you to think about every 4th of July, every Christmas that you get to live and my son doesn't. But when Matt was in the hospital, and I think it was right after he passed, the spokesperson from the hospital comes out, and, you know, Judy thanked everyone for their love and their thoughts. And she said, just go home and give your child a hug and let them know that you love them. And I'm going to put that just a step forward, give your child a hug, but then also go and vote. And, you know, I can't say go vote enough. We're doing an event on September 17th with HRC and One Colorado to get people to sign up to go help people get registered, or, you know, sign up for, we call them Candidates of Equality, because I'm also a part of Hate Free Colorado, which is interfaith. It's LGBTQ. It is organizations of people of color. It is, you know, religious organizations. And, you know, we're trying to get them to all do it, because one of the things I constantly say is, if all of us who are considered marginalized, which I'm beginning to get irritated with that word, but we could become the majority if we all just stood together and voted. And, you know, that's why our foundation still exists. We need to be educating people, and we need to be changing, as we say, hearts and minds. And that's one of the most important things we can do.
Yeah, 100% agree. I think it's funny you use that term. There's an investor local here that she just launched her fund. It's called the New Community Fund. Her name's Danielle Schutz. And one of the things that she says is, she likes to use the term underfunded, specifically talking about fundraising. She's like, it's not that they're underrepresented, even though they are, it's that they've been underserved, that they have not actually gotten the same attention or resources that everyone else. So they've been underfunded. So that's kind of the term she uses, which I like the ideology behind it, of, you know, it's it puts it back on her, is what she says, you know, puts her back on her as the investor to make sure she's serving an underfunded community. So I think that's an interesting one, but definitely I think the term can get, can be interesting, I think, to have a discussion about.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes we preach to the choir a lot.
Yep.
And I want to figure out a way to get outside preaching to the choir and get to those people who are the ones, the 101 million that aren't voting, the ones that MLK said, you know, are sitting there not doing anything, which is worse than doing something, you know. Yeah. And that if we can crack that nut, then, you know, that will be helpful. And I hope that people are seeing what is going on in some, like, if you're sitting in your living room and you see some of these people spouting hate, and you may not live in their state, but you should go and try to vote for a candidate who is supporting equality.
Yes.
100%. You know, and so that's one of the things that we at Hate Free Colorado, it's just a conglomeration of all of us groups that are trying, and it's a lot of law enforcement. Mm-hmm. You know, we're trying to say equality candidates because, of course, we want people to support people who are supporting LGBTQIA+, but that's also equality. Yeah. And so that's also for people of color. That's also for, you know, people of different abilities and, you know, all of that kind of stuff, which are just not being represented as much as they should be. The election in Alaska thrilled me.
Yeah.
The first Native Alaskan to be elected to the House of Representatives over
Sarah Palin,
the former governor.
Yeah. It was crazy. I did not expect it. Like, I don't think I was following it very closely. And then it popped up on my timeline, I want to say earlier this week, and I was just reading some about it, and I was very intrigued. I was like, I should have been paying more attention to I should have been paying more attention to the Alaskan political race. But that was a huge win. Very huge win.
Well, and sometimes I think one of our problems too, and that's where we as nonprofit organizations who have listeners can go to. I think there's so much, like, living here, I stream more than I watch the news because I'm always on CNN and I'm always, you know, MSNBC, and I'm checking the news. But oftentimes I think sometimes people just tune out the news because it's just all so negative. Mm-hmm. Even on, like, the positive side of like the news stations, that I can't imagine watching some of the craziness that happens from, you know, the MAGA news stations and things like that. So, you know, we're moving into, and this is something the listeners may not know about. Matt was just interned a couple years ago at the National Cathedral. I was living in DC and had, you know, I've known Judy and Dennis forever. So I was honored to be invited to do that. They didn't want to have him in a cemetery with a gravestone where there could be graffiti or violence, or, you know, they wanted him to have a final resting place that was going to be safe. And, you know, I've had a lot of people call and say, you know, there should be a monument in Laramie. You know, we want to go visit the fence. The landowners don't want people on their property. And, you know, so, you know, that's a moot point. There is a bench commemorating him in front of the Arts and Sciences School. But Matt being at the National Cathedral is so important because he is down in the crypt and is safe. And we go there every December 1st for his birthday, and we do a service and, you know, allow people to come down. I hope I get the name right. St. Joseph's Crypt. And it, you know, it's like people like Helen Keller are there and others, and it's a very safe place for him. And it makes the shepherds feel very comfortable that he won't be vandalized or, you know, defamed in any way. And, you know, thanks to the National Cathedral and the Episcopal Church for, you know, for being very much a part of that.
Yeah. I think that's so important. I think he's got to be able to rest, I think. And yeah. I think that more importantly, the shepherds need to be able to rest and have that kind of concern put to bed that you don't have to worry about someone literally vandalizing.
Right. Can you imagine going and seeing your son's tombstone with fag on it or, you know, something like that?
Just horrific. But okay, Jeff, I'm going to switch gears here a little bit because I want to listen to know about you. Okay. I want the hero story. Like how did you, where did you start? Take us from kind of where you started to where you kind of graduated college, and then we'll take it kind of from there kind of professionally, but go ahead.
Okay. So, you know, like I said earlier, I grew up in Chugwater, Wyoming. Everyone who I have ever spoken to after I came out, my dad's wife, my stepmom, was like, "Oh, honey, I knew since the day you were born that you were gay." And she and I share the same birthday. And, you know, I was not an athletic child, but I was a very intellectual child. And, you know, we created academic competitions, and I was in speech and debate, but I had to go to Wheatland, Wyoming, 23 miles away, to be on any of those teams because, you know, my school was so small. Yeah. And, you know, I didn't know what gay was, but I knew that I was something different. And, you know, so growing up in an environment like that, and you know, there were terms that my neighbors used that I went to college and used. And people are like, "Oh my God, you can't say that." You know, I don't even want to say the terms that they use, but I would say, "Oh yeah, I blah, blah, blah." And they're like, "Oh God, you know, that no." You know, so it was a loving, embracing community. And I always felt so comfortable there. I wanted to go to the Air Force Academy or Notre Dame. We were super poor, but we never wanted for anything, you know, like we always had clothes. We were farmers and we had cattle. We had a couple cattle, lots of sheep, chickens, geese, ducks, rabbits, and big gardens. So we were, you know, somewhat self-sustaining. So when I tell these stories about going out at 3 a.m. with my dad and our neighbor to check cattle and pull calves at 33 below zero, everyone looks at Jeff Mack and goes, "You?" So, you know, that it was very formative in a way of like, I felt almost like I had a private school, because when you have one math teacher teaching three students calculus, you know, you're getting very one-on-one attention. And we had something called tie-in TV, which is where, because there were a couple of us that were smarter than the capacity of our teachers. Not that the teachers were bad, but we had this giant satellite. This is late 80s, early 90s. And we had this TV where we had this lady from San Antonio teaching us physics. Oh. And if we had a question, we had to pick up this landline phone and call in the question. And that's how we took physics, because the school didn't have the capacity to be able to do that. So that, like, those kind of stories, people just don't believe that. Then, you know, I've traveled the world and have worked at amazing organizations. I went to, begrudgingly, I went to the University of Wyoming. I wanted to go anywhere else, but I met Kathy Reagan, who she knows you. You just probably don't know her. She used to be the director of admissions, and ran up to her. Like, my mom was like, "Go do this." And so I did it, you know, got accepted, went. And it was probably one of the smartest decisions I've made, because my mom was in a motorcycle accident and was in a coma for 3 years during my parents' divorce. And so I became her guardian. And before the divorce, she was going to go to Eastern Wyoming College and get her teaching degree. And so I was my sophomore year, I transferred out of the university and was going to go help her with her first year of college. And then I got an apartment there, but was going to help with the ranch farm. And then a couple of days later she had her accident, but then I was too far in. And so then I just managed the ranch, but then I went back to Wyoming, the University of Wyoming, and joined a fraternity. And all my fraternity brothers were like, "Dude, you should have come out to us a lot earlier. We all just knew." I was, you know, president of the fraternity. So apparently everyone always knew that I was gay. I was just not ready to, you know, tell people. Went and worked for my fraternity, worked in Pennsylvania, New York, and New Jersey. I was in Richmond for training, but drove around in my car in Pennsylvania, New York, and New Jersey. for a kid from Chugwater, that's quite a thing. And then I moved back afterwards. I wanted to work on the Hill and thought I was going to, but then I drove back to pick up all my stuff in Laramie, and I was offered a job at the orientation office or the admissions office. And I decided to take that job. And that is where then I found the LGBTQ. I don't know if we had Q on there at the time. The timeline of adding the letters always gets me a little bit confused. And that's where I got to know Jim Osborne, who you might know or remember. He was one of the angels and is still a good friend of mine. And that's where I got to know Matt. And so I had a tiny community of people who knew that I was gay. I was out at the office, which is why when Matt was murdered, I wasn't supposed to go on the Jackson trip. Someone else was supposed to. It was supposed to be two women, but one of them got sick. And they're like, oh, Jeff, you can go. And you and Tamara can share a room. You're gay. You know, nothing's going to happen. You know, so this is, you know, late 90s. I don't think they would ever do that to anybody now. But there was one morning, and my boss, Kathy, called me and said, well, she called, and this is pre-cell phone, talked to Tamara, and she goes, I want you to hand Jeff the phone, but I want him to sit down. And I, you know, I take up the phone, and Kathy's like, sit down, Jeff. I was like, why would I have to sit down? She goes, I have some news for you. I was like, with what I've been through with my mom, you know, what, whatever, no. But she goes, sit down. So I was like, fine. And she told me about Matt, and she goes, cancel all the rest of your appointments, come home now. And so we drove, and actually there was a blizzard in the middle of Wyoming in October, but we made it down and we made it to homecoming. And the night before homecoming, we all made the yellow armbands that if I was at my office today, I would show you. It's the armband I still have. And I was a homecoming judge, and I don't know how I got roped into that, but as the parade was ending, and this is also in the Laramie Project, all the LGBTQ members had a banner with the yellow armband with the green circles. And then everybody just started filing in behind it. And so like the entire community just, you know, it started out with, you know, dozens and dozens, and then it was hundreds, and it just became this huge thing. I still hadn't come out completely yet. And I was asked by Father Roger at the 1 year anniversary to give the opening prayer for the anti-hate violence vigil. Mm-hmm. And I did. And I stepped to the side and I was hugging my friend, and I have forgotten her name by now because I'm getting old, but she looked like a, you know, young boy. And it says, Jeff Mack consoles unknown male companion. And that was going to be in the Rocky Mountain News. That was going to be on the nightly news. So I immediately had to come out to my entire family within 24 hours because I was living this very bubbled and sheltered life. But it worked out mostly.
Did you resent it not being kind of your decision and being forced into it?
No. Because like my grandma, who used to call me short stuff because I was really short for a very long time, immediately got in touch with me, and she goes, I love you, and I just want you to be loved. And fast forward, you know, 15, 20 years, my grandma had Alzheimer's, and I was living in DC, and I would send her a dozen roses every week, and I would come back and visit, and I didn't have the money for the roses, but I did it. And I would take her out to lunch, and she'd be talking. She's like, do you remember that guy that I was married to? And I'd be like, Grandpa? And she's like, what was his name? I'm like, Paul. And then she looked at me, she goes, when do I get to meet someone you love? So she always knew, and that always makes me cry, but like that acceptance was so ingrained in her head that even in dementia, she just knew that she wanted me to be loved by someone. And I just, that woman was absolutely amazing. And, you know, it's one of those neat stories.
It's beautiful.
But then after seeing everything that happened, after the trials and working in Laramie, I loved Laramie and I still love Laramie. I just needed to go on and try to do a crusade. So I moved down to Denver and worked for a bank for a little bit and met this guy that worked for HRC. And I was like, I want to go save the world. So I interviewed for HRC, worked for the Human Rights Campaign for 4 years, and then went to LA and worked for the Gay and Lesbian Film Festival there, and then went and worked for Point Foundation, which helps. It initially was like homeless or abandoned LGBTQIA plus kids get to college, and it still is. It's a resource for underfunded kids to go to college. But I said I need to live in DC, and so I moved back and worked for this place called College Summit, trying to get more people. It's first generation low income and people of color into college. And then I went to the Red Cross for a bit, for 4 years. I had a very short stint with this woman called Swanee Hunt, who is amazing, who is all about women's rights. And then the Kennedy Center called and went and worked for them for 4 years. So I've had a lot of jobs, but all fundraising, and the arts were great. But then right before the pandemic, I decided to move to Chicago because one of my best friends was there, and I'd been in DC for a total of 14 years and basically worked from home the entire time I was in Chicago because it was pandemic. Yep. But then Bob Wittick from the foundation called and said, Judy would like for you to come run the foundation. And he's like, she doesn't want you to say no to her. So I'm calling first. And I said, I'm sure we could work something out. And it was a fairly quick move. I just celebrated my 1 year anniversary with the foundation, and I've come full circle, and it's where I'm supposed to be right now. And I cry a lot, but that means I love my job and I love what I'm doing. And it's just, it's an honor to even be associated with Judy and Dennis.
What a heck of a story though. I think it blows me away to hear like the credentials that you have in places you've worked. It makes so much sense why that gala went off so well last year. It's probably one of the best galas. It was amazing.
I will not take credit for that at all. I have an amazing team.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I think I had a question about when you were at the University of Wyoming. Do you remember how contentious, or what do you remember about when my dad ran for student body president?
Because I think I was running at the same time, mm-hmm. but for just a senator.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember what year it was.
I think it was 96 or 97.
So it must have been 90. If it was 96, actually, I think it was 97. I was senator the year before. Gotcha. And so then I wasn't again, and I was moving away. But I'm trying to remember, like, what was the issue?
People didn't like that. Number one, he was black and running for student body president, but he got a lot of some things I remember him telling me was, they would pull down office posters. He would go up or wake up early, put up all the posters up. They'd tear them down. They wouldn't tell him when debates were happening. It wouldn't give him a heads up. And so he would find out from posters around thing that, oh my gosh, I have a debate tonight. I got to run and do a debate. We got a bunch of death threats. People called our house saying, oh, we're going to kill you, this, that, and the other. We even had the, I don't know if it was the FBI. I always get this wrong, but it was like the FBI, some federal agency essentially called him and said, we're a little fearful for your life based on the threats we're getting from the community. And I believe it was the one and only time I think it was the city of Cheyenne brought in their actual election equipment to do the actual voting. And it was just kind of interesting. There were some interesting things that happened, some very discriminatory things that happened. I think one of the things that is just the biggest jibe still is that when he actually won the race, I think to your point, I think one of the things I heard in your story about kind of the day, the parade, right, of everyone at Wyoming kind of coming in, is that people in Wyoming may not say a lot, but they're down to ride. Like, that's one thing I will say is he won by a landslide. It was very obvious. People were like, it's not okay for anybody to be treated like this, and we have your back. And so I think that speaks volumes to the majority of people at the University of Wyoming. But I think one of the things that still bugs me was when, after he won, you're probably familiar, all the presidents get their picture hung up.
Oh, yeah.
in the thing. And they acted like they didn't know how that happened. And so after he won, they wouldn't hang his picture up. So my mom actually had to pay for and get his picture printed. So to my recollection, he is the only president in UW history who had to pay to have his own picture hung up on the wall.
Wow.
So
yeah. So that happened in the year between me graduating and then me coming back.
Gotcha. Okay.
But I do remember a lot of that because I would come back and visit a lot, and you know, I was still very well connected with everybody at the university. But yeah, so I was a student senator until then. And I tell you what, student senate was very not diverse.
Yeah. Makes sense. I mean, the nice part when you look at that wall now, I think is it has a lot of diversity of presidents kind of after him, but it's very interesting to kind of see the cutoff point. After that point, but I was just curious if you remembered anything about that. No worries. So my other question here is kind of to bring it back around. I'm going to re-say this question, but I'm just going to kind of in general try to get it out here, is about diversity, equity, and inclusion, specifically yes. around organizations. So when we look at companies, a lot of them make commitments, initiatives, public statements about diversity, equity, and inclusion. We usually see it, you know, in response to George Floyd, in response to legislation getting passed in like Florida, for example, in Disney. But what have you seen kind of those companies that go deeper with their diversity, equity, and inclusion programs and initiatives? What have you seen them do? Like what is the thing that they might be missing? Or what's just your general comment on kind of the statements that are being made?
You know, it's always been something, even in the nonprofit world, to try to diversify your workforce. And in speaking to a lot of the employee resources groups, I spoke to dozens over Pride. And I think oftentimes, you know, as you look at June, all the rainbow flags come up. And then everyone's like, ooh, let's talk about LGBTQIA+ and, you know, how we can be better. But I don't think enough people say, how can we be better for underrepresented populations? Who is speaking to their ERGs? You know, I know employee resource groups, many companies have LGBTQIA+, women, people of color. You know, there's a myriad of employee resources groups, but I think the companies that are really doing a good job are the ones that are funding and giving resources to those ERGs to be able to go out and to recruit people of a diverse population. Because I mean, and once you, if you have a diverse population, you have perspectives and you have an opportunity to be able to make better decisions as opposed to just, you know, groupthink or the way that, you know, white guy sitting around a boardroom.
And I love that, because I think something that always gets missed is you have to fund it. You have to pay to have diversity. Like you pay for having a marketing department. There would be no expectation of, like, I think one of the things I get all the time, which would be interesting to get your response, is a lot of times I hear people say things like diversity and inclusion should be everyone's responsibility, which I don't inherently disagree with. But in a company, everyone should be fiscally or financially responsible, but we still have an accountant. Like,
right.
It becomes something that I think people, it's a great sentiment. And I wish it was true that everyone could kind of accomplish this and get this done. But I think, kind of to your point, you have to have that level of funding first behind it in the accountability, right? These conversations are so complex and going on in so many different groups to act like people's whose job this is something they do in addition to their job, be a part of an employee resource group, to act like that's going to be enough to change your overall culture and manage all these different aspects of experience.
Right.
I think it is naive, right? Like, it doesn't make sense.
Well, and, you know, I'm going to say this, and it's probably an uninformed statement, but June, you start seeing all these companies flying rainbow banners and doing all this stuff. But what do they do for Black History Month? What do they do for, you know, Asian Pacific Islander awareness or Women's Month, or I'm probably calling half of them the wrong names. But, you know, the months that are dedicated to populations that need the employee resource groups that are the underrepresented or underfunded, you know, it's very easy to hang a rainbow flag. But what are they doing during Black History Month? Are they doing something for highlighting leaders of that organization that have been a person of color in the past or are current, or, you know, using it as a recruiting tool? We can see through people who are just plastering things up at the month that they want to do it. But if they actually have meaningful programming, then that is something that an organization can do. One of the things that this is from a past organization, and I know it created quite a bit of a stir at a time, and you're seeing it a lot more in Hollywood, colorblind casting. And what I mean by colorblind casting is, and the Washington National Opera in DC, Francesca Zambello, who's their artistic director, is committed to it. And it's one of the most diverse staff. Just because a character was written in 1780 or 1640 and was supposed to be a white woman or a white man doesn't mean that a person of color or someone else can play it. And, you know, so there have been some backlash to that. But I think those kind of steps of just saying, you know, we have these Hamilton, for goodness sake, you know, I mean, was one of the leaders in colorblind casting, because, I mean, it's the founding fathers, but it's a diverse cast. And so, you know, if the corporate world can take a little bit from the artistic world and just understand that we are stronger in our diversity than we are in our segmentation or segregation, then we will understand that you and I can have a conversation and you're going to have different ideas and you're going to change my mind. Mm-hmm. And, or I'm going to change your mind, or we're going to come to some middle ground. And those companies that are really just not plastering up things every month when, you know, something is happening, but actually having great programming, are the ones that are going to be the leaders.
And I think what I hear there, and what it made me think of when you were speaking, is kind of this concept of there's a chapter in my dad's book. He just released a book not long ago. Yeah, thanks.
And sad I didn't get to go to the opening.
We didn't have. Oh yeah. I remember that. Yeah, it was okay. It was maybe like 10 people. Didn't mean to out him, but it wasn't a whole lot of people there. But anyways, there's a chapter about, they call it like Four Shades of Brown. And my point here being that there was a company that essentially thought, when we look at white people, we need over 30 different shades of colors of skin. But when we look at brown and black people, four shades should cover it. And so to go back to your point of colorblind casting, it becomes very difficult for someone who isn't in the room to call out that four shades of brown isn't enough. Because if you would have had someone, if you would have had a black woman in there and you would have tried to pass, hey, we're only going to do four shades of brown, she'd been like, what are you talking about? Four shades of brown, that's not enough. So I think there's sometimes a miss that it is extremely important when your product is meant to serve everyone, that everyone's in fact in the room, because they're going to understand and identify those things from a product or marketing perspective that you didn't even realize. They're able to inform. It's not enough just to post in June or post in Black History Month. You actually know those people are part of the company, so they can actually help you inform and build better products so you can become more profitable.
There's this group that we just started working with called Prideful Beauty. And it's a makeup line. It's bath bombs. It's all sorts of stuff. But it's supposed to be a color fluid and gender fluid makeup line. And they sent us a whole bunch. And there's spokespeople that are doing, that are going to be doing, it's launching in September. Oh God, it's September now.
I know, right?
and they're launching, and they sent us the packages of makeup that they're sending out to the spokespeople. I was hoping for the bath bombs, but they sent out the packages. And one of my staff, Dana, she's like, hey, can I go through all of your packages? And we just started, because she was like, I'm a darker skinned person and I need darker skin makeup. And so there was like, and we just like laid it out on the table, and there were so many colors of makeup, and these people, Prideful Beauty, did such a good job of figuring out that it's both for, you know, those with lots of melanin and then, you know, people like me who have none. And, you know, and it was a great way for us to actually look and see how diverse that they were with what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And to just be encouraged that, like, we have partnered with someone who is making this okay for, like, a trans person to be able to wear this makeup, a person of color, you know, anybody. Like, this makeup is basically made for everybody. And it was cute for us because we were, like, trading makeup. And I gave mine to the drag queen that painted me for Drag Eye. But because I was like, I'm not going to use that much makeup in my life, but it was an interesting act of, you know, seeing someone looking for their skin tone in makeup that oftentimes the beauty companies don't take into consideration.
Yeah. Another thing that's interesting about that is that there's a picture that I have of my dad in his setup to have lighting when he does, like, things like this. Because of his skin color, like, cameras don't really pick him up well. And I remember we were watching the Super Bowl, and Google had just announced that they had a camera that could pick us up. And I remember people being like, why are Black people freaking out about this? And all of us were like, we finally get picked up in pictures. Because a lot of times it's so dependent on the lighting that, like, we have family pictures and my dad or my grand, like, you can't see them. Like, they just show up super Black. So it was something, you know, I still, of course, have an iPhone. But it was something that I was like, I seriously might switch from an iPhone to Google because it meant so much to me to even just see a product that saw me as a consumer, like saw more of me as a consumer than just like not being seen. It was very interesting. Like, so I think I love that company and that idea because it's so needed.
And, you know, that was a very awakening moment for me where they showed the picture, like the before picture and the after picture. And I was just fascinated because I've never thought that I glow in my pictures, but, you know, my eyes are usually shut. So that's my only problem. But seeing how that they took that thought process and said, so they clearly had someone in the room who said, hey, we're not being seen in more ways than one.
Yep. Exactly.
Fix it.
Yeah. And it's funny, like how did this not happen? Like, you think of how long cameras have been around, like how did it take this long to do it? Well, it's because these people haven't historically been in those rooms to make decisions, or they have been in the rooms, but they have not felt empowered or in a safe enough space to be able to speak up and say, hey, this is missing something. We need to do something. So I think it speaks a lot to progress that we're making. Obviously, there's always more progress to be made, but I think it was such a validating step, especially from such a large company, that we're making steps in the right direction. So,
well, and one of the things I have found that has helped me, I will always say, like, this may be an uninformed statement, so please, you know, correct me because I want to continually learn. Barbara, I'm going to say her name, Barbara Polk from the Human Rights Campaign helped me understand so much about myself and so much about diversity and inclusion and code switching. And, you know, she and her husband are, you know, hugely successful. Their sons are brilliant. And, you know, she would share experiences with me of, you know, I tell my sons, you know, if you get pulled over, you put your hands on the counter. I had brunch with, I don't know if you know who Morris Price is. He's just one of the most amazing human beings in Denver. And we were just having a casual conversation at brunch. And he said, yeah, my friend got pulled over. White guy driving. Morris, Black guy. And Morris just put his hands on the thing and, you know, had his wallet out. And the white guy was like, well, what are you doing? He goes, this is how it works. And so that was an awakening moment for his friend in that, you know, we have so much distance to go in DEI. And, you know, even bringing it back to the LGBTQIA+ community, we have to protect our trans, I hope they don't mind me saying brothers and sisters, our trans family, especially those of people of color, because those are the ones that are being attacked the most. You know, I live half a block from Colfax. I could walk to bars, but there are still attacks happening to LGBTQIA plus people leaving bars. We have to continue to be hyper-vigilant. I constantly say hyper-vigilant and hyper-aware. And by that is, we just need to watch out for each other. And then I always going to say it again, we have to vote. We've yes. got to get rid of these people that are using the rhetoric of, you're different than me, so you're bad.
Yeah.
You're a different color than me, so you're bad. You're a different sexuality from me, then you're bad. But why? What have I done to you?
Yeah.
You know, and we see these people who, I try not to mention names because I don't want to give them, you know, more press than they are worth, but like, you know, telling, Buttigieg, get out of my bathroom. You know, that kind of thing of we're not a, people that are different than you are not predatory. They're actually being the predatory people right now. And it's sad. And I hope that the listeners to this can take at least one thing away is we need to make change. Mm-hmm. We need to show that we are open to diversity. And if they're listening to this, I'm 100% sure that they are. And that we need to just do small steps to make sure that people understand that we are an open and safe space.
That's fantastic. I think I'll go ahead and ask the question, but you basically just answered it. So when you look at diversity, equity, and inclusion, what do you see as one of the missing pieces from our understanding, creating, or just in general?
I think that so many facets of government, corporate America, some nonprofits are not accurately reflecting the communities that are served, that they are in. And if we have people who are making decisions when they are completely unaware of the repercussions that will impact those communities, that is the fault. That is where DEI is crucial. And that's, you know, it's scary to stand up and to try to become a person, you know, in office or whatever, but we need to unite our voices in saying we need things to reflect the communities that we are in. And, you know, I know there are some communities that are not diverse and, you know, so that's not going to be a terrible thing, but, or a terribly easy thing to do. But as leaders, as people who are activists, we need to make sure that everyone has a voice at the table. And that's when we actually will be able to get things done appropriately. If it's just, you know, 30, 75-year-old white men in a room making a decision, we're all going to be left out.
Couldn't have said it better myself, Jeff. Couldn't agree more. Last things here. Want to give you the platform. What do you have coming up? What do you want to tell our listeners to be on the lookout from the Matthew Shepard Foundation and just Jeff Mack in general?
We always do something in December around Matt's birthday at the cathedral. And then that will then start marking our 25th anniversary. So what I would love listeners to do is every dollar, every penny counts. If people even just got on and said, I will give you the amount of a Starbucks coffee per month, that changes. We are a small organization and we use every penny to try to change the world. So if people can go to matthewshepard.org and give us some support, that would be great. And give us a shout out. We're always looking for Matthew's Place, which is our LGBTQIA plus youth platform. And we have people telling their stories. It's a resource place for people to be able to talk about their transitions. We talk about books. We're trying to get a resource about banned books that are out there because I'm hearing a lot of that. Would love for people to follow us on Twitter and go to Matthew's place. We have great resources. We just need more people to know about us.
Fantastic. Well, Jeff, thank you so much. And thank you to our listeners. This has been Finding Diversity. You can find this podcast anywhere you normally get your podcasts. And if you like the show, please subscribe and leave us a review. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Finding Diversity, The Missing Piece. You can expect new episodes monthly. And if you like the show, please subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. This helps others like you find the show. Finding Diversity, The Missing Piece is powered by Cape Inclusion. It's produced by Studio Deed Podcast Production, directed by Prescott Wong, and hosted by me, Justice Thompson. To learn more about how you can get started and to book a demo, visit us at capeinclusion.com.